have members present, Representative Edgman, Representative Jewell, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Fairclough, Stoltz, and Representative Costello to take up Senate Bill 1 and Senate Bill 90, and then continue our work on House Bill 106. We have the sponsor of Senate Bill 1 was by earlier. Regrettably, circumstances didn't allow us to get to it. I'll invite the sponsor staff. Acknowledge everybody's read the sponsor statement, so we don't need to reread that. Welcome, Co-Chair Thomas.
You can just present a summary of the bill, Mr. Obermeyer, after the appropriate introduction of yourself for the record.
Members of the committee, Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you is the committee substitute for Senate Bill 1, Education. It's 27LS0001/B as in Bravo. It's an act relating to the requiring that the State Board of Education and Early Development provide an annual report to the legislature. This bill requires that the State Board shall prepare and present in person to the state legislature not later than the 30th day of each regular session a written annual report that describes the efforts.
I said we'd already read the committee.
Oh, you did. I'm sorry.
I missed that. We're trying to. So can we summarize? Back to order.
Basically, the bill just asked that the Board of Education make an annual report to the legislature at the beginning of the session rather than toward the end, as often has been the practice.
Are there any questions for Mr. Obermeyer? Invite the department up. Mr. Morse, so please, we want you on the record acknowledging either opposition, acquiescence, neutrality, whatever you choose.
My name is Les Morse, I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department for the Record. The department will work with this legislation if it's passed and be able to work with the State Board to deliver a report in person to the legislature.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Morse? Is there anybody from the public wishing to testify in this bill? Is there anybody on teleconference network wishing to testify? Nobody has signed up. We'll close public testimony. Looks like we have a zero fiscal note. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I move from committee the CS for Senate Bill 1, Education 27-LS0001/B. From committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
There are no objection. The bill's passed. Note how fast we can move the Senate bill. We'll stand briefly at ease. Back in order to take up Senate Bill 90, the public accountancy secretary. Welcome, Mr. Owen. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dana Owen. I'm staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. This bill was brought to us by the accountants who had expected after House Bill 315 passed in the last legislature that they would be able to hire an executive secretary for the board at a range 23. Indeed, the amount of money for range 23, it was specified, and the range was specified in the fiscal note that passed with that bill. I believe in your packets you have both that bill, or excerpts from that bill, and the fiscal note. Because of a position classification study done by the Department of Administration, They were unable to hire somebody at a range 23, and in order to fulfill the legislative intent of that bill, we felt it was necessary to actually add this provision into the statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Owen. Questions for Mr. Owen? We all have deep interest in accountancy issues here. Representative Hawker isn't here. He would actually have some questions. I'm sure. No questions. Just you can just hang there. Just next, we have Mr. Mertz from the board. Do you have anything you would like to have on the record, Mr. Mertz? Okay. Is there anybody here in Juneau wishing to testify on this bill? Hearing none, is there anybody on Legislative Teleconference Network wishing to testify on this bill? As reference, we have a, we'll close the public testimony. As reference, we have a zero fiscal note as previously described. Those that were here last year probably remember that bill, and we could do a tutorial for those that weren't here after the committee. That Representative Birdbuck.
Mr. Chairman, I move from Committee to Senate Bill 90-27-LS0551/A with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Hearing no objection, that bill is moved out of committee. We'll take a brief recess to get ready for 106 and let everybody get back into place. I think they'll probably expect this efficiency level. Either was up. Finance, come back to order. It's about 12 minutes to 2. We'll continue where we were, kind of a little bit jumping around. We'll come back to the resource co-chairman and describe their work in that previous committee. Rick, Senator Feige, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Eric Feige, representing District 12. You guys all, at this point, have the sectional analysis in front of you. I'll just go down sort of section by section and explain how we got from a simple six-year extension into the resource version of House Bill 106. Section 1, we didn't do anything to change what the governor had requested. It's still a six-year extension to the Alaska Coastal Management Plan. In Section 2, we established the Alaska Coastal Policy Board. As I alluded to earlier, we decided on a 9-member board, 5 public members, and 4 commissioners, but 3 resource commissioners, natural resources, fish and game, and DEC, as well as Commissioner of Transportation. And we selected him because the Transportation Department, although it does not issue permits, it has a fair amount of experience in obtaining permits and felt they would be a good pick to be on the board. The 4 members of the 5 public members, 4 will be picked by the governor from essentially 4 regions that we define in the bill to spread their, basically, so you don't get one part of the Alaska coast more represented than another. So 4 members picked from a list provided by each of those regions, and then a 5th public member, also selected by the governor, who the only requirement is they must reside within the coastal zone, and that is also picked by the governor. And it was our general thought that that at-large number could come from industry. As far as the members of the board that are commissioners, we also specified that deputy commissioners may act in the place of their commissioners.
You had a big grin from Joe Balash there.
Any questions on Section 2? Okay, Section 3. One of the things that came up out of our deliberations on this bill was that there were concerns that the coastal districts bring up with the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management, and that those concerns kept coming up because the problems didn't seem to be getting addressed within the division. We required an annual report as to, in this case, the regulations pertaining to the ACMP, kind of a progress report, reporting back to the legislature how the Department of Natural Resources was coming on making changes and drafting and adopting the ACMP regulations. Going down to Section 4, just technical language that says they could, the Department of Natural Resources could cooperate with the board, and then number 5 dealt with, or Section 5, the duty states, basically states that it's the duty of the department to provide the planning and consistency review data and information to members of the governing body of a coastal resource district or coastal resource service area, and to other persons that may be designated by those areas. One of the things we found is that there wasn't a good flow of information going from the department to the districts. In many cases, it was being sort of short-circuited, and people in the coastal districts were being left out of the information flow. The changes we made in Section 5 specified who gets that information, and specifically that it goes to board members in the coastal resource service areas, as well as to folks that administer programs in the district. Where that information goes beyond that is still up to the districts to designate. Section 6, another problem that arose was some of the restrictions on the use of funds to run the coastal management programs. A lot of the funding is made through pass-through grants that originally start with the federal government. That money typically comes down to the DNR, and DNR is tasked with making sure that money is spent according to the rules that accompany it. And some of those rules include that it may not be used for lobbying or writing legislation. That money thing is routed sort of sideways through the DCED, I believe, and then given in grants to the coastal districts. The problem that arose was that that money was being used by consultants for other than what it was allowed to be used for. There was the reaction then within DCED was to restrict the use of that money for consultants at all. That's not the intent, but we put language in the bill that says if money's coming down, the department needs to specify what that money can and cannot be used for, and that it, and what regulation or statute that authorizes the restriction. Section 7 requires that the coastal management plans not conflict with statewide standards. And again, Section 8, also that it may, plan may not conflict with the statewide standards adopted by the department. It also changes what a plan must include and changes the requirements for enforceable policies contained within the plan. Section 9 was certainly a sticking point for the governor, and that was to retain the DEC carve-out. The reason the DEC carve-out is there in the first place is that the timeline for a lot of the DEC permits is not measured in days, it's measured in months or in some cases years. It was originally felt to exempt or keep DEC out of that, out of the ACMP consistency review process was something that allowed a consistency review to stay on schedule. Keep in mind that one of the prerequisites for getting your DEC permit, be it water or air, at the end of the overall permitting process, is that you have to have the consistency review determination made first. So it's not like DEC is simply exempted from the permitting process. Section 10 addresses whether or that the when a district submits a coastal plan, if there are disagreements, and then that plan goes to the Coastal Policy Board for review. It requires the board to review the plan and make recommendations, that's all, on whether the plan should be approved or modified in whole or in part. And at that point, the department makes the decision as to whether or not to approve either the entire plan or just pieces of the plan. But the final decision is up to the department. The board is there for recommendation purposes. And Section 11 gives a reconsideration period. Or the district may request a reconsideration of the department. Section 12, which we, there's certainly some issues that need to be dealt with on Section 12 in the wording of it. Essentially requires the department to approve a coastal district plan if the plan does not conflict with statewide standards and enforceable policies, do not duplicate, restate, incorporate by reference, rephrase, otherwise modify or adopt, or are preempted by state or federal statutes or regulations. So essentially an enforceable policy cannot duplicate something that's already in the law. The enforceable policies may establish standards or requirements within the state or federal authorities of that agency unless the state or federal agency specifically objects. And we took out the requirement for a designated area that would apply, that would have enforceable policies only applying within that designated area. The biggest sticking point for the coastal districts was being able to define a designated area for an enforceable policy to apply specifically in the realm of subsistence, because especially in some of the larger areas, subsistence areas are not generally that well or that easy to define, because you subsist where the game or fish resource is. And there was the history of the program over the last 7 years. That was a major bone of contention with the between the coastal districts and the Department of Natural Resources. Section 13. Allows members of the coastal districts and coastal resources area to participate in the consistency reviews. And that same routing of information with the having to do with the coastal plans, we tried to ensure that information chain was retained, that everybody got the information, that didn't just go to one consultant, and then the consultant got to tell the districts what was going on. Again, trying to bring everybody into the process and keep everybody on the same sheet of music. Section 14, in the consistency review process, if there is a determination and then the determination is contested or parts of it are disputed, that constitutes what the program refers to as an elevation. And previously, the commissioner of DNR was responsible for adjudicating that dispute in the elevation. He was, as the point of view from the coastal districts, was here was the boss of the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management, essentially making a decision on his own division's performance. And it was generally perceived that that was not sort of like the fox guarding the hen house. So what we elected to do here, instead of having just the DNR commissioner make the ruling on the elevation, we brought three commissioners, the three resource commissioners, into that process and required that at the end there would be a written order to adjudicate the dispute. On Section 15, we have a 90-day limit. It suspends the 90-day limit during the time the consistency review is under elevation. And back in 14, that elevation period was limited to 45 days. So we retained the timelines that are very important to keeping keeping projects on track and under a keeping a certain amount of certainty in the program. Section 16 defines what a reviewing entity is, or what the reviewing entity is. In this case, the three resource commissioners or their deputy commissioners. Section 17 requires that the modifications to the Coastal Resource Service Area Plan not be inconsistent with statewide standards. Section 18 are some definitions of what an elevation constitutes and what a special management area is. 19 gives a sunset to the board. When we originally put Section 20 together, we had actually areas that merit special attention and special management areas. They were essentially the same definition of the same thing. We got rid of areas which merit special attention and just left the special management areas in there. 21, some transition provisions on the board membership. Section 22 is in there to make sure that this, if there for some reason there's a delay in getting the bill signed or transmitted to the governor, that even if it's signed after the 1st of July, that it, I guess it reverts back. Make sure that there's no gap to where the program can legally sunset. And then Section 26, an immediate effective date. Any questions?
I have one. I highlighted all the comments that the AG referred to. I don't know how many is in here. I take it that people will be talking and you're going to fix those. There's about
nine here. I understand that there's already a fairly active conversation going on between the governor's staff and folks within the coastal district, specifically the North Slope Borough. I expect that over the next day or two, the differences really are not that significant. There's a number of them, certainly, but a lot of the differences are not substantial differences on the way we set up the program. Essentially, the lawyers have had a week to look over the fine points of the actual language. As we were drafting this, we did not have the CS language in front of us. We had our own individual amendments. We pulled it all together at the end of our amendment process, and then industry as well as the administration knew what our concepts or our general intents were, but the actual language of the CS did not hit the street until last Tuesday, I believe.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Feige, welcome. I believe it was in Section 12 you talked about subsistence. And I was looking at the meaning of a special management area. And on page 14, A, B, and C, where it talks about areas of unique historical significance and cultural value, high natural productivity, and essential habitat for living resources, and areas of substantial recreational value, opportunity. Would that open a door or an opportunity, or is that an area where special management areas could require a subsistence priority, do you think?
The definition of the special management area is broad, and I believe that's one of the areas that they will be looking to tighten up. As to whether or not it would dictate a priority, no.
Through the chair, for the record, Bob Heron, House District 38. Through the chair to Representative Newman, I think that the comments made by the Attorney General about the label special management area. He was concerned that that would give chance to open it up to the unintended consequences. But when Representative Jewell and I met with the Attorney General this morning, we weren't so concerned about the label. And so he just wants to make sure that the label of these areas is going to change from special management to something that fits under the Department of Law, so that there isn't, we don't create another window. But I don't think it was so much worried about subsistence per se. I think he was more worried about things beyond that. But to answer your question directly, is that if it does fit within the policy, statewide and other and district, yes, it could cover subsistence. And the example, that's why that section is so important about designated areas, is the complaint has been that it was a conundrum. You have to specify a subsistence area, even though you might not know what it was, if you were going to be able to use it for subsistence. So if it wasn't designated subsistence, then it came time for the department to review a policy or a project in the future. The district was in a conundrum because you didn't designate it, so you can't comment on it. And the example that I used in resources is that, for example, you need in 10 years, the village needs a new airport. And nearby, there is a gravel pit source. There's a source. And so that barrel pit will be used only once, and it will never be used again. But under current law, they would have had to designate for a future project that they may not be aware of, or the state might not be aware of. And so they would not be able to comment on a subsistence activity because they didn't designate it. And so, again, probably one of the most important parts of this proposed legislation is the removal of the designated areas. I mean, really, that's one of the pillars, to borrow Mr. Balash's phrases, is that is the key, one of the keys to the proposed legislation, is the removal of designated areas.
But at the same time, we took away those designated areas, the standards for what an enforceable policy could be, those definitions we tightened up a fair amount as well.
To the chair.
Representative Newman.
My concern is right now with the Alaska statutes, and this was a very controversial, talked about issue. Subsistence priority, it separated management on federal land, state management of fish and game, particularly game. And my concern is this going to open up that can of worms, or if there's language in there, if you can have a designated area that you can have a priority that has a priority for subsistence use because of the language that it states here, with because the area is of unique historical significance, cultural value, essential habitat, or recreational value or property opportunities. That was my concern. So is there parts of this bill, do you think, that say if it already interferes with existing statutes such as that maybe, as you at the police said, unintended consequences? Is there parts of this bill that say, you know, I mean, if we got statutes that already mandate how these areas are managed, I don't think it was the intent to do that here, but I think that opens up a door for a challenge on that, and I don't know. I guess it was that your intent or not?
It was not our intent to establish a priority for subsistence use. By removing the designated areas, you allow those enforceable policies to apply across the full breadth of a coastal district. The enforceable policies still are not supposed to supersede or exceed the state or federal government's authority. If there is a, if there's an objection on the part of the state or federal agency that's responsible for that particular area of management, and they object, then the enforceable policy is set aside. So to answer your question directly, it was not our intent to set aside specific priority subsistence areas. But it was a compromise to allow enforceable policies to apply across, specifically enforceable policies that pertain to subsistence areas, because it was very difficult to define those subsistence areas. We removed the requirement for designated areas and allowed enforceable policies to apply across the coastal district.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have asked for an opinion from law and the Attorney General on that one also, just for the committees, just to kind of make sure that we've got that question answered by those folks, and also how it would pertain to access, access for Alaskans across these lands and into these fisheries lands, just to make sure that we're a little ahead of the game, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's three places here that make reference to not in conflict with statewide standards or not inconsistent with statewide standards. How does that conflict with trying to form enforceable policies that are localized? And it seems like your all enforceable policies have to meet some criteria that's also statewide. But you're trying to do, but you're trying to localize issues and how it affects the different districts. But you're also saying it's not inconsistent or not in conflict with statewide standards.
Sure. Through the chair, Bob Heron again. Representative Guttenberg, when we were having our discussions with Mr. Balash in developing this, we at the time thought that the deletion of the, for example, Section 7, page 6, line 6, is by deleting the statewide standards and then including the changes, the underlying changes to, we thought it was there. Now in discussions with the Attorney General, is now the debate has gone from whether we should just have the sentence start with all reviews and end with 040. With the underlying being deleted and the statewide standards and being deleted, but that'll be in the crafting of the finance CS the correct way to do it. So to answer your question, at the moment I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Guttenberg, follow up. Are there other questions from committee members? I'd like to take us to Section 2 for composition of the board. I believe, Representative Feige, that you said that it certainly would be up to any governor to actually look at the area-wide position, but that it was your belief that there would be inclusion of industry on the board through this particular appointment?
Not specifically, Madam Chair, but was our intent. It certainly left open the possibility, because Anchorage is within the coastal district, that a member of industry could be appointed as a public member to the board by the government.
Could you speak to me as to the compromise or the conversation that happened regarding access to coastal community resources by people who hold leases, and how that interplays with other regions that would benefit that aren't represented. So what that really says is, my understanding of underground rights are that at least under the Native Claims Settlement Act, that mining resources are to benefit all Alaska Native corporations. I want to make sure I'm getting that right. And so that if all representation isn't at the table and a coastal community or a particular community, it doesn't have to be mining, it could be anything, can't access that resource based on a decision of a board, how can we make sure that there's meaningful evaluation and conversation representing all interests instead of just coastal community interest? Alaska is affected by the policy in general.
Madam Chair, the board is appointed by the governor. You have four members on the board that are commissioners that work for the governor. Mining specifically is a lot of mining activity is not necessarily covered under the coastal management plan, I don't believe. And we didn't touch any of that language in the bill at all.
So, Madam Chair, I guess I have to ask a question. So to clarify what I thought you were asking, is are you talking about 7i money?
Representative Heron, I'm talking about Alaska, the people of Alaska's underlying interest. Specifically, the Native community has an underlying interest in some minerals that are in grounds that are occupied outside of coastal communities. And so there's that particular position, and there's all of Alaska's position. So my understanding of what we want to do is create a meaningful process for those that are affected in a community. I don't want to get it wrong on how they're affected. I don't want to put words into their mouth, but they're affected in some way. And we're trying to mitigate negative actions inside of their environments. But the rest of Alaska has a vested interest in what happens on those properties. If we were looking at just oil and gas, the permanent fund receives contributions into the permanent fund based on oil production, and the people of Alaska aren't specifically represented except in the commissioner seats. And in the current composite, the commissioner seats can be outweighing the decisions of the administration. The public sector that has representation on the board can outvote the administration. I haven't seen that on any other boards.
Madam Chair, keep in mind that it is a recommendation by the board. We looked at the coastal management program as essentially having a fund side where coastal districts create plans and establish the rules for development and resource projects within their districts. It is important that those rules be clear, they be as complete as possible, and they be upfront. So when an applicant starts the consistency review process, which we sort of call the backside of the program, the rules are already out there. They know what the rules are. They know they complete an application which details how they are going to comply with those rules. And then if there are any disputes, the board is not involved in the consistency review process. The board is involved with making sure those coastal district plans are as good as they can be on the front side. The state's interests are certainly represented during the consistency review process, and any disputes in the review process are adjudicated by the commissioners, which represent by way of the governor, the people of the state.
Madam Chair,
Representative Heron.
I give a chance at your question. Is, again, all nine members are part of the governor's appointees. After the resources version came out, the discussions with Mr. Balash and the third floor continued, and so we got down into how that fifth board member would be chosen, and it was pretty much a consensus amongst all that it should be someone that is one of the regulated groups. So we're encouraged by that, and as an individual legislator, I'm not opposed to that. But it truly at least the way the resources version states it up, they really do build, like Representative Feige said, they really do just help build the plan. They're not in the review process per se. But I'll say at this time, though, is, you know, obviously my constituents would rather they have an additional role, maybe like reviewing the regs that DNR comes up with under the DNR, under DNR. So we're looking to strengthen the role of the policy board, but at no time will they have a place to veto anything. They really, truly are going to be team players, I guess, if you want to say it that way, within the process. So, again, we'd like to see them review regulations by DNR related to coastal zone, and we have, at least I do not have an issue with it being a regulated entity as a fifth person.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Representative Edgman.
Maybe just to add to what your question, I think, was attempting to sort of seek in terms of an answer. The way I understand is that the policy board itself is acts in an advisory capacity, and that the binding authority still exists with the Department of Natural Resources at the very end of the sort of equation, even if you did have to go through the three-member resource development sort of appeals process. You know, DNR would still play a significant role. So I see the point, Madam Chair, that you're making about the structure of nine representatives on the board itself, then five are sort of at large, you know, could outvote the four that are designated through the resource development agencies. But the way I read this bill is that the board itself still very much is in an advisory capacity and can recommend, maybe at best, if that's not putting it too simply. So to go to your point, but also to sort of drill in on the true impact of this, the legislation, you're really, the buck stops at DNR for all intents and purposes, the way I read the bill.
And Representative Edgman, through the chair.
Representative Feige, thank you.
That is correct. Again, to reiterate, and this is before I got into the whole coastal management program, I had really only been exposed to the consistency review process. But it's two halves. The first is coming up with the plans, those districts establishing the rules for applicants to operate under, and then the second half is the consistency review process, where the applicants they apply and demonstrate how they are going to conform to those rules. So it is important that those plans be as complete as possible. This is where a lot of the coastal districts had, there was a lot of frustration because they weren't able, or they didn't feel as if they had complete representation in that coming together and creating that coastal management plan. By having the board there, by having it as a recommending entity, the Commissioner of DNR still has to approve the plan. And if there are disputes, those disputes will have recommendations conveyed by the board. On the backside, any disputes in the process will be reviewed by the three commissioners. And hopefully that will keep everything predictable.
Representative Edgman followed by Representative Costello.
A few years ago, I used to work with the CDQ program. In terms of the jurisdiction of the CDQ program, great contention, but ultimately we decided that it would be 50 miles radius inland from the breadth of the Bering Sea throughout the western coast of Alaska. But maybe, Madam Co-Chair, we can get some discussion on the reach of the coastal service district areas. As I understand, is somewhat related to the salinity of water, salt water versus fresh water, and so forth. So if we can get some kind of a response to that, please.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Representative Herron, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Representative Edgman, as well as all the committee members, is that Mr. Balash could give the, you know, verbatim correct definition. But essentially, it's related to the tides. And so it is, for example, Bethel has its own coastal district. But it is, you just go up a couple of miles, and then you're out of the district, and there is no coastal district. So it truly, it is a true ribbon all around the state. And there is no inland reach. And in fact, the Resources Committee made a very specific motion to include inland reach, and it was defeated 0-9. We made it very clear that there's, in whatever legislation results, there is no inland reach in coastal zone management.
Thank you, Representative Heron. Representative Costello.
Thank you, through the Chair. My question has to do with page 10, lines 18 through 21. So when I read this, it says that the enforceable policies in a district coastal management plan may establish new standards or requirements that are within the authority of a state or federal agency, unless the agency, federal or state agency, objects. So my question is, well, what is within the authority of a state or federal agency? Well, in the state environment, it's to write laws that are then carried out by the department. So essentially what I read this doing is giving the management plan, the enforceable policies that are specifically now given to the state in our authority to write a law. So therefore, what we're doing is we're allowing the enforceable policies to have the weight of law unless the feds or the state objects. Well, what happens if the state doesn't object? The enforceable policies are given the weight of law, and then a future legislature wants to change the state law. Seems like what we're doing here is we're giving away the powers of drafting law, setting law to the district coastal management plan and those who write it. So my question is, if that situation, I mean, aren't we then setting up a conflict here in terms of powers that are specifically given to the state now to write law?
Representative Feige, Representative Heron. Representative Heron, just for the record, we're trying to keep the clerk in the meeting minutes. If you just identify yourself before we...
Bob Heron, Representative Costello, this morning... the Attorney General shared with me and Representative Jewell and then with the full committee that this is a federal agent. It'll probably have to be dropped. But I think you raise a good point if a state agency does not specifically object but wishes to do in the future, we'll deal with that. But unless that language is in there, why do we even have coastal zone management?
Representative Costello.
Through the chair. Well, it seems like there's an opportunity here that if the federal government philosophically lines up with the state administration, that would be an opportunity to amend coastal management plans that might not otherwise be approved under different situations. I mean, it seems to me that we have specific powers that are given to the state, and I don't know if it's within the state's authority to give those away. And I'm just curious how you would address that problem.
Well, under the program, through the chair, Representative Costello, is that the feds have given the state that power, and the feds can come in and trump us anytime they want when it comes to coastal districts. And so I guess that in the crafting of the finance CS in cooperation with the Attorney General on the third floor, this may change. But again, I think I have to emphasize, because my good friend from Kotsky is not in the room, but unless we have language like this, which the administration at present supports other than a federal agency, why should we have a state coastal zone management program? mean, if we can't, you know, if a local district can't at least attempt to draw up policies that are important to them, why don't we just let the feds do it all?
Follow up?
Through the chair, could you explain to me then what is the driving purpose of this program? I mean, what relationship are we trying to, what is the purpose and the original purpose of the Coastal Zone Management Program?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I'll use a poor analogy, is if it's almost like, it's a poor analogy, but it's almost like if they're your friends and neighbors in your neighborhood want a specific ordinance, but the people in the Valley of Juneau didn't like it, it's almost like letting the Juneau Valley residents say that your ordinance isn't worth a hill of beans, and they would have the opportunity to object to what you want for your neighborhood. Now, it's a very poor analogy, but again, it's about what's important to the local district, given the caveat that we have no veto power when it's of statewide importance. And the last thing that everybody wants, I believe, in the room is we don't want the feds to run coastal zone management. So there has to be a balance between what your neighborhood wants versus what neighborhood a long ways away wants.
Representative Thagy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Costello, through the chair. The enforceable policies will apply within those coastal districts, and only within the bounds of those coastal districts. It's very difficult to foresee exactly what an enforceable policy would be wanting to implement or areas that they would be wanting to try to protect or resources that subsistence resources that they would be trying to protect. The purpose of this paragraph is really to give the state and the federal agencies that have authorities to manage particular arenas, give them the final say to object to a specific enforceable policy, but not without really curtailing the ability of a coastal district to present an enforceable policy that they wish for their district.
Thank you, Representative Costello. I just wanted to, for the record, to say that Representative Pierre has been with us for some time. We were just going back and forth with particular questions. On Representative Costello's question regarding the AG's, Attorney General's comments, on this particular section, I believe he also asked about the retroactivity aspect of the law in regards to this section. At least that's what I have in my notes. And so I don't know if you've taken up that issue, or at least that was a comment I wrote down on this particular page under his comments. So if Representative Heron or Representative Feige have a comment on that, either now or in the future, that would be helpful for me. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make in somewhat response to the point that Representative Costello brought up, is that to amplify the comments from Representative Heron and Representative Feige, is that the Coastal Zone Management Program is a creature of Congress, and it dates back to 1972, and it was legislation enacted in recognition that the challenges along the coastal areas of the United States more sensitive in terms of finding the balance of both protection and development, that that there should be, in some instances, higher standards or higher authority granted to local entities, whether it be along the Great Lakes, whether it be on the Gulf, whether it be along the 34,000 or more miles of coastline in Alaska, and that Alaska chose to join the Coastal Zone Management Program, I think it was 1979, 77, one of those two dates. And so henceforth, to get the point that Representative Heron was making, sort of rhetorical point, was, you know, if you don't have some sort of enforceability provisions in the program, then why have the program? It really goes back to the congressional intent back in the early 70s. Furthermore, when Congress passed the law in 1972, they also decreed that state entities should have that same standing with federal agencies when it came to development projects and the review process along the coast. So I'm probably saying a lot of what you already know, but I thought it was an important point, an important distinction to make.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Maybe an urban example might be service areas. When service areas want to have local control in urban areas, they can overlay districts, and those districts can either have increased standards if they agree to pay for those standards in the form of services or whatever, or decrease standards to allow individual community reflections. So in the area of Eagle River Chugiak, we have a park service area where, as a community, we choose to pay for all of our projects up front, per se. We don't like to carry debt inside of our service area, and we carved ourselves out away from Anchorage and said we can maintain our own parks and services in a different way than Anchorage does. We have a volunteer fire department that maintains services different because it's a community value to have that service area. So it might be a way that urban can reflect on what a coastal community might want for their individual areas. But we certainly also don't set laws that are different. They work in the confines of state law, over the top of municipal law, over the top of the service area. But just as an example for service areas or urban area residents maybe to wrap their arms around, is that we look at different services under our service areas. Representative Newman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Feige. We haven't heard too much about it today, I don't think, about I just want to maybe get a sense of the conversations that happened in the Resource Committee on the DEC or the role of Department of Environmental Conservation, DEC carve-outs, and have to do with coastal zone management. Was there, what discussions went on in your committee on that? Was there substantial or?
I would say there are modest discussions on the DEC carve-out. The governor was pretty upfront that he wanted to retain the DEC carve-out. And we ascertained that just by the nature of the permits one has to obtain through DEC and the length of time that it can take, sometimes in excess of a year, it was not appropriate to wrap those into the consistency review timeline, which right now is generally about 35 to 50 days.
Representative Newman, follow up?
Yeah, Representative Feige, could you give us an idea of what your sense of what is the DEC carve-out, just so we all have a good understanding of what we're talking about here?
Representative Herron?
I'd ask the administration to do that, but I'd like to have the question that Representative Newman imposed to the co-chair of resources is, of course, he's a former military officer and still a gentleman, I guess, is that he was polite. It was a very vigorous debate about DEC carve-out. And not only did Mr. Balash, on behalf of the governor, and Larry Hartick, the commissioner of DEC, they came in, they were very emphatic that things were going to change. And so the discussion came to the point where my constituents wanted there to be, at least during the review consistency review process, is at least DEC was in there, you know, advising people, yeah, you can say that, no, you can't say that. But we never really got there. So it's not that we've given up, at least my constituents have not given up, but DEC carve-out is not a major component of this CS, and I don't anticipate it being part of the finance CS.
Representative Newman,
No, Madam Chair, if you would maybe ask DEC to go over that with us when we get to that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Newman. I have that written down. Other questions from committee members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Herron.
I neglected to say something this morning. I have to emphasize is on behalf of Representative Jewell and myself, the administration has done a yeoman's job on, you know, trying to figure something out. So, again, I appreciate and admire what they're doing in this process because this is very important to all of us. But maybe a little facetiously, but, you know, everybody's got a favorite number. So between 1 and 10, my favorite number is 106.
Well said, Representative Perry. I have a couple finer point questions. Lindsay Walter, are you online from the Department of Law?
Yes, I am.
Lindsay, I'm looking at page 3 of the bill, and I've read AS 3905080, number 4. Could you talk to me about the transition of policy board members under, as it's in regard to this? It's on page 3, line 17 is the reference. If you need a minute, you can get back to me privately.
Okay, so I just want to make sure I understand your question. You're asking about what happens with the transition of the members?
Yeah, it says, with the exception, on line 16 on page 3, except as provided in AS 3905080, number 4. I've read that. It's a significant paragraph in state statute. Could you talk to me about how policy board members transition between new governors? I believe that's what it's okay. In reference to.
If you don't mind, I would appreciate answering that privately. I'm at the LIO and I don't have my statutes here, and I can't remember what that paragraph refers to.
Thank you. Continuing on in section 14, we heard concerns raised about 45 days and what the administration would do or DNR would do. And Mr. Balash, if you could join us possibly at the microphones if our questions are starting to wander into a different area without objection from committee members.
Please.
And just in trying to keep everyone sane around here, when you answer, just identify yourself at least the first couple times so that we make sure our records accurately reflect your comments. Balash, section 14 refers to 45 days, and the AG had some concerns stated of what would happen if the 45 days weren't accomplished.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner to the Department of Natural Resources. In section 14, the statute lays out a series of steps relative to elevations. And this is speaking specifically to the consistency review process on implementation. And if the applicant or project sponsor or the coastal district is unhappy with the proposed determination issued by the reviewing entity, which more often than not is going to be DCOM, the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management, they can request or elevate the determination up to the commissioner under current law and up to the resource commissioners in the proposed language here. The statute language as amended would read that the process shall be completed with the issuance of a written order within 45 days. The question we have as an administration is what happens on the 46th day? I'll tread carefully here, but it would not strike me as unusual if three of our commissioners had four opinions, none of which would be the same. So then how do you get two signatures? So we would like to get some certainty as to the consequence or effect on Rule 46 if that has not occurred. And so that is an area that we spent a considerable amount of time discussing in the resources committee, but this is the language that emerged.
Representative Heron.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Balash is correct. Again, this was another vigorous debate. But in the history of this session, the opponents to changes to 106 have always argued that there has to be predictability. during the review process. And now, this morning, when the Attorney General and Mr. Balash met with me and Representative Jewell, they suggested that maybe that 45 should go away. And so what happened to predictability around here? And so we're very concerned about that. Now, is there another, you know, another way to describe predictability in that section? Yes, we're very much interested in having that dialogue.
Representative Heron, do you have a suggestion that would be palatable or a consequence for it not happening? And it doesn't have to be on the record. Or it can be off the record later. But, again, the issue's been raised, and I wonder what happens on day 46. Do we, as a finance committee, take money away from DNR? Do we give a yes verdict if they can't act quickly enough? Do we give a no verdict? If nothing happens, does that mean that they don't want to take it up and it just quietly goes away? It reminds me of do not pass, make a recommendation, do pass, make a recommendation, amend, no recommendation at all. And do you have a preference on – I understand you want a timely response. I just would look to those who want the coastal zone management to be reauthorized and those who are administering that process to provide us a compromise. I don't know what that time is. I don't know what's on DNR's plate to make that number, but it's been raised as an issue. Representative Heron?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Attorney General has indicated to us that, in short order, they will come up with language that we can all consider. Again, in crafting the finance CS, my constituents just raised the point that this is important to us because we have been accused of changing coastal zone management, so there's no predictability. And so how can you have predictability unless there is some predictability in this one discrete section? So, obviously some would argue that John Burns is the smartest lawyer in the House, and so I look forward to looking at that language.
Thank you, Representative Heron. Representative Edgman, did you have a comment on that?
Yes.
On that point, because I have others in line.
Yes, I did, and that's to comment that isn't the consistency determined process at present revolving around two sort of timelines. One's a 30-day, one's a 50-day timeline. And isn't there an elevation process involved with that as it exists today?
Through the chair, this is Joe Balash speaking again. Representative Edgman, depending upon the type of review being conducted and the activities in question, there's either a 30-day review or a 50-day review. When the reviewing entity, and again, most often that is going to be DECOM, issues a proposed consistency determination, it is around day 44, if I recall correctly, and day 24 in the respective timelines, that proposed determination is written down and provided to the applicants, the districts, and everybody involved. And there are certain decisions that have to be made by the parties at that point in time. Under the current law, the review participants, districts, or applicants can request an elevation, and that goes to the DNR commissioner. The DNR commissioner today can make up his mind in 45 days. But when, as proposed here, you elevate that decision-making process to three commissioners, the mechanics of that get to be a little more tricky. Now, when an elevation occurs, the clock stops. And so the number of days required or left in the review, the counting of those days stops while this elevation process occurs and goes on. But the underlying principle in the statute is that consistency reviews can be completed in a maximum number of days. And so as soon as that 45 days and the elevation stops, the clock begins again on the consistency determination itself, and that will be completed by day 50 or 30.
Representative Edgman. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. About the only coast in my district is the coast of Westchester Lagoon, so I'm not probably up to speed the way you gentlemen are, but I do have a question. What happens if we don't pass this bill out?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, again, Joe Balash, DNR. The Coastal Zone Management Act, a federal authorizing statute, has created this program as a voluntary program whereby states can or not participate. And so in our case, our program would be repealed, and our participation in the review of projects and activities in the coastal zone would come to an end. Now, there is not a federal agency that would step into the place of DECOM and conduct these reviews, but the state would be left without the ability to affect some permitting decisions that occur in the coastal zone. There are certain federal activities that we do enjoy some ability to steer through the consistency review process in the coastal zone program. We would lose that.
Representative Dugan, follow up.
Thank you. So if we don't, then insofar as there is any control of activity in these areas, it's going to be federal control. Is that right? Or will there be places where basically anybody can do whatever they want?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, if only that were the case. My understanding is that the permitting processes would go on just as they would in the center of the universe in the interior of Alaska, and without the consistency review process at the front end of that permitting regime.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dugan, any other follow-up?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
Actually, I wish to, in part, join in the response to Representative Dugan, and is that what happens? Well, heavily in debt, Uncle Sam gets to take over, is the sense of the easy way to put it. But I think that if you could, Representative Dugan, if you could go back and reread Dan Sullivan, the mayor of Anchorage's letter to the Resources Committee on his position and his assembly's position on 106. It's pretty remarkable how they view the world now on coastal zone management. And this is prior to the recent decision on Beluga, but prior to that, it will help you considering that here you live in Anchorage. I thought the letter was remarkable.
Thank you, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't recommending that this happen, but clearly any action that we have or don't take is going to have impacts, and I was curious to know about what the impacts might be in case, for some reason, we weren't able to come to agreement in time to extend this program. Thank you.
Representative Dugan, we are not the other body. Representative Thomas.
Thank you. I believe if we don't revise the coastal zone management going, coastal zone management staff laid off, right? I mean, in the operating budget, it's terminated, and if this bill is not renewed, they're laid off anyway. And that's about, 3.4, 3.6 million in savings. Upside, downside, we're going to look at it, but.
Representative Thomas, you certainly could look at that differently. It may cost us, Representative Thomas, a lot more.
Just one way.
I meant to, sir, in dealing with the federal government and trying to access our property or coastal communities' homes. Representative Newman asked a question earlier, Mr. Balash, regarding the DEC carve-out. Could you talk to the committee about the carve-out and what that means?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DEC carve-out is found in AS 4640.040B, and in that section or subsection of the statute, it cites the statutory authority that the Department of Environmental Conservation has to administer the air, water, land, and contingency plan response, oil spill response planning authorities for the department. And 040B says that those authorities, those statutes, and the regulations adopted pursuant to those statutes are the exclusive policies for the Coastal Zone Management Program in Alaska. And what that means then is the issuance of a permit by DEC automatically constitutes consistency. And the point in all of that is that certain major permits that DEC issues have very complicated and drawn-out timelines. And in order to participate in the coastal management program and complete a consistency review, you need to bring a complete application with all of the information contained in order to start the clock and begin the review process. Those timelines don't quite match up in many cases, and so there's first the timing question that gets involved. The second part is that some of the requirements for air and water standards and the rulemaking, the triennial reviews that the department goes through, are requirements under their federal Clean Water, Clean Air Act authorizations. And because the state has primacy, we have to do certain things certain ways. And those standards and the way that the department goes about setting those standards need to remain within federal compliance. If you go down the road of allowing districts to have their own standards on air and water and so on and so forth, you start to run afoul and get out of sync with those federal requirements. And so for all of those reasons, DEC is carved out and considered to be consistent and exclusive in the program overall.
Thank you, Mr. Balash. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll chew on that one for a little bit.
Thank you, sir. I just wanted to make sure. If it's the will of the committee, I'd like to see if there's anyone available that would like to testify before the body on this issue. If you'd remain seated, is there anyone here in Juneau that would like to testify on HB 106, Coastal Zone Management? Is there anyone online wishing to testify on HB 106? Seeing and hearing no further public testimony, the public hearing is closed. Any additional comments for Representative Jewell?
Not for the members, but if we're about ready to adjourn for the day, then I would wait.
Representative Jewell, I was going to recess us because I'm not sure. Brief at ease. Is there any further questions from committee members regarding Coastal Zone Management in 106? Seeing none, I'm going to recess the committee. I believe that there's a CS being worked on. I'm not sure if that is going to be back to us before we're called back onto the floor today. Mr. Co-Chair, do we know what we're doing tomorrow?
So I don't have that either here.
Representative Jewell.
Yeah, before we recess, Madam Chair, you know, it's been about 5 years that we've been waiting to have this discussion and to listen to all of the issues that are being brought up by the different members and raised by the people who work the issue in the administration is a wonderful change of where we've been. And I've said at the beginning of this session that I actually believe we're closer together than we are far apart. And I think that, that even though we're 6.5 days out from the end of session, I still have confidence that we can reach a level of agreement to bring closure to this. And I would much rather have a coastal zone system within our state and with state processes in place than not. And so I hope that, and I know that people will be working diligently on this issue to try and help this along. But I've been looking forward to this discussion for a very long time.
Thank you, Representative Jewell. Comments from other committees? Hoping that was going to tell me. I've just been informed that we can adjourn until 8:30 tomorrow morning, so I just didn't want the clerks to have to stay online if we were going to move further. Representative Edgman.
Can I just ask one simple question?
Oh. And I'll
direct it to the co-chair of the Resources Committee, but I'm going to just sort of very quickly inject some of my opinion in here, but my opinion is that if we craft this program right in a way that provides for meaningful impact while respecting the resource agency's ability to make the binding commitment and to fulfill the Constitution and uphold all the laws, this, that, and the other, that this program will in fact be an enabler for resource development as opposed to a disabler. I know that that's a subjective statement, but, you know, I could say that I've heard that sort of implicitly throughout all the comments that the two members from the previous committee have made in describing the bill and doing the sectional analysis. But if that's a little bit too forward in terms of your taste, relative to your own personal opinion or what have you, feel free to say that. But that's my opinion, and that's something that I've strongly believed in all these years that Representative Jewell has been talking about, that this could actually bring, through the collaborative process, local regions together with the state, help us form a buffer against some of the NGOs and the other interventionists that really bring us in the court for years and years on end, and that we're really solving maybe more than one issue here going forward, as opposed to just the local side. We're looking at the statewide interest as well. So if either of you wanted to comment that through the chair, I'd be interested in hearing your comments to that.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edgman, through the chair, I do agree with you. And if we have a well-defined, organized, and enforceable, if you will, coastal management plans for all our coastal districts. Simply by defining the rules of the game up front and as clearly as we possibly can, we add certainty to an applicant's decision to go forward with the project. We, by defining a timeline, we give that applicant a firm commitment to the amount of time they have to budget in their planning process and the execution process of their project. So anything that goes to making the outcome of an applicant's consistency review more certain goes a long way to helping reduce the risk and the uncertainty of various what-ifs along the way. So in that light, it will, in my view, as well as yours, increase the potential for more resource projects down the road.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Representative Edgman. The three of us sitting up here, you know, we have no fantasy that we had crafted the exquisite bill that needed no other changes, but it's a process, of course, that's set over and over. But what was what was good about what the Attorney General said this morning is by him looking at it where it is truly the citizens and state government, it's our process, and he doesn't want to rebuild completely rebuild the CS. He wants to make sure that the NGOs and other entities that want to take down responsible resource development in our state through litigation. And so I think that it was a breath of fresh air for the Attorney General to say that he's not going to rebuild this CS. He is going to make sure that there are limited opportunities, if at all, NGOs and others that want to take us down. For, like I'll use what Mayor Itta said in front of this committee several weeks ago, is that there's people outside of Alaska that want to save us. They want to save Alaska Natives. They want to save coastal districts. They want to save anybody that lives here from ourselves. And so I agree with you that we do have an opportunity to forge something that's responsible, and I look forward to those discussions in this committee.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Any other comments from committee members? With that, we're adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning.